And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's spring in the Northern Hemisphere. Birds are returning. Flowers are beginning to appear. Kids are visiting nature centers. Bikes are getting pulled out of garages and readied for adventure. And yet, gasoline prices are surging to new highs, and global warming churns up new challenges. We take a look at all of this and more when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
If you're like me, you may be noticing that the bird song is increasing in any number of ways. First, there's a lot more of it. Second, it's a lot more intense. And third, there's new calls that we haven't heard for a while. Yes, it's the sound of spring. And today, we're going to start out by visiting a number of nature centers around the country to see what's happening right now, today. Then, following the news, we head on out to the Monterey Bay Aquarium and get an update on what's happening to those wonderful sea otters. And then we head just a little south to San Francisco and visit with the Presidio School of Management, which is offering a master's degree that combines the best of all possible worlds into a future that is better for us all. And then in our final segment, we hear a lot, and I mean a lot, about sustainability these days. Now, if it's one of those words that you've heard about but haven't really gotten a grasp on precisely what its definition is, not to mention the myriad terms we hear about global warming and climate change, carbon sequestration and credits, this whole new lexicon of a sustainable world is hard to understand, but it just got a lot easier because the Dictionary of Sustainability is now online. And that's all coming up in a great springtime show. But as always, we start with the news. It's spring, and it's a time of hope and wonder. So today, we bring you a special version of the news. This is the real nature news that deserves just as much airplay as any other. So now, a very special series of reports from around our nation.
My name is Beth Heckman. I'm the Assistant Education Coordinator at the Great Bay Discovery Center in Stratham, New Hampshire, located on the beautiful Great Bay Estuary. And we've been noticing a very interesting thing, and that is the osprey coming back this time of year. And in fact, we had volunteer training today, and all of our volunteers here got to see an osprey dive and get a fish out of the Great Bay right while they were having training. And it was everybody was so excited and stopped everything. That was one of the great things that has happened this week. You can go to www.greatbay.org, and we're on that site.
I'm Pete Smirud. I'm here in Finland, Minnesota, and I work with the Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center, located in the hills overlooking Lake Superior on the north shore of Lake Superior, Minnesota. And today, here on the ground in the field at Wolf Ridge, it's a warm day. It's a very warm day, and we have about 250 fifth graders out exploring the woods and the trails of the property here, and classes and everything from acid rain to stream study to animal tracking, et cetera, et cetera. And just this afternoon, right after lunch, a student had commented on how warm it was and was asking us about climate and climate change. That's a topic on everyone's minds, and what was interesting to me was the fact it was on the mind of a 11-year-old student walking around here at Wolf Ridge, not prompted by anything. And he had just completed weather class, and one of the topics in weather class is looking at forecasts, both from a local perspective, is it going to rain tonight, tomorrow, and also looking at it on a climate perspective, or the sort of the average weather over a period of time. And he was rather tuned in already to the idea that this spring, and we've noticed here at Wolf Ridge this spring, that the passerines, the small warblers and sparrows and birds like that, are returning earlier this year. And they commented, they learned about that in weather class, that we track phenology here, that the differences in seasonal changes, when the first geese are migrating south, when the lake freezes over, things like that, and that we have been noticing this early change, and he as well noted this back in his class, or in his backyard, in Orono area of the western suburb of Minneapolis, where this student was from. And that on the ground today in Finland, Minnesota, it's warm, the birds are back, and the students and everyone is noticing the fact that it's a bit earlier this spring than we're accustomed to, and raising questions in people's minds about, is this normal? Is this what we expect in the future, or is this just a fluke today? For more information about Wolf Ridge Environmental Learning Center, you can find us on the web at www.wolf-ridge.org, or you can give us a call at 218-353-7414. Thank you very much.
My name is Heather Banks. I'm the director of the Pratt Museum up in Homer, Alaska, and right now in April, we're getting ready for our wildlife camera viewing season. We've got a couple remote cameras out on a remote seabird rookery in Kachemak Bay, which is where Homer is located in south central Alaska. And we've got another camera out at the McNeil River Bear Sanctuary. Usually they get set up in the spring. So we're working on our funding and technical issues with these cameras this year, as we usually do about this time of year. And visitors come to our museum and control a camera on the seabird rookery. They explore puffin burrows, and it's a great educational tool for kids, and people of all ages really enjoy it. And then they can also transport themselves to a remote bear sanctuary from inside the walls of the museum by looking at a camera and watching bear behavior, brown bears that are across the Cook Inlet here close to the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska. So those are just some fun things that we're working on, and we can't wait till the birds return and the bears start coming down to the stream, and we can observe them again this summer. It's a lot of fun. Our website is prattmuseum.org, PrattMuseum.org, and we are up in Alaska, and our phone number is 907-235-8635.
Hello, I'm Sue, a volunteer at Botanica. I've worked here for 5 or 6 years as a volunteer, and I just took a walk out in the botanical gardens here in Wichita, Kansas. We have 9.5 acres of beautiful flowers that we plant year-round. There's always something out here, even in the winter. Today it's spring. There's not too much wind at all. It's a sunny day. The daffodils are in bloom. The tulips are beautiful. We have pansies, and in our pansy house, we have butterflies in the summer, and they will enter in June. And so for today, and the pansies are in full bloom, there's also a gift shop out there called the Hollyhocks Gift Shop. The daffodils, the lilacs, the forsythia are all in full bloom also today, and they're talking now about planting the annuals for the summertime and the rest of the spring. We had a luncheon here today. We have that catered every Wednesday, and including in the Botanica admission. We also have a lecture. Today was wood carving. We sometimes have things on herbs and any number of different activities that happen in Wichita. The lecture is 45 minutes long. And if you're in Wichita, Kansas, please visit Botanica. We're open Monday through Saturday, 9 to 5, Sunday, 1 to 5, and Tuesday evenings until 8, starting in June. We also have a great variety of entertainment here, special events, concerts in the summertime, out on the terrace, where they also have catered meals. You can bring your own picnic, whatever you'd like to do, and stroll through the gardens. We have a special little cocktail, like mimosas and marigolds, on Tuesday evenings in the summertime. We've had quilt displays, artists paint pictures and display them, and we showcase them. We have a teddy bear picnic in the fall. the volunteers number probably about 300 to 400, and we have a tea or a coffee and a meeting the second Tuesday of the month. So please join us anytime you're in Wichita, Kansas. And if you'd like to contact us, our telephone number is 316-264-0448. If you'd rather visit the website instead of calling, our website address is www.botanica.org. Thank you very much, and hope to see you at Botanica.
And that's the news. And a special announcement. If you have interesting news that you want covered on your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News, send me your item from our email link, or just send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. Include your contact information, and I'll be happy to give you a call, and who knows, you may have your voice here on the Wild Side News. Well, it's time to head on up to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, because there's some newly released information on the sea otter population that needs our attention. Following a fairly successful population increase over the past 50 years, from a period at the turn of the century over 100 years ago, something has changed, and the population, which numbers about 2,400 animals, has had some good years, but a few too many bad years. Andy Johnson talks about what's happening to the sea otter populations along California's coastline.
Yeah, the trend line in the mid-1990s started a downturn, and that was a very strange twist. We thought the population was in good shape. In fact, the federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, was even contemplating, in a few more years we might be able to delist this population, to take them off the threatened species list. And right about then we noticed this downward cycle. We got a couple counts in a row that were down significantly. And really over a period of about 5 or 6 years we saw, quite a large drop, 400 or 500 animals. And really just in the last couple of years we've seen a couple of good increases, with a slight drop last year. And now we're planning to count the otters again in early May. But it's just a real challenge to try and figure out what is the difference between a population that is even increasing at 5% and a population that may be decreasing by 5%. It probably doesn't take too much, either in some environmental change or a new disease or something that makes this from a growing population into one that isn't growing.
Now, are you finding fewer animals, a lower population levels, or are you finding that there is an increasing death rate?
It's a little hard to put our finger on. We've actually seen that the numbers are up, I don't want to say at record highs, because historically there were many more sea otters along the coast here, but since we've been counting the early part of the 20th century, and certainly over the last several years, the population has increased with a few dips along the way. But I think the real issue we face is that we're seeing signs of a population that may increase from time to time, but also signs of an unhealthy population, possibly the reason why they don't grow at a higher percent. And then in certain years, maybe El Nino years or other years, we see the population turn downward. So what we try to look at is as many of the dead otters as we can possibly recover. Any otter that comes along the beach in California that shows up dead, we try to get our hands on it and do a full post-mortem exam. The California Department of Fish and Game is taking care of that. And try and figure out why each of these animals die. And our best estimate is that we may get as many as 50% of the animals that die each year, which is a fairly extraordinary number for any wildlife population. And of those, a certain percent, maybe, I'm not sure what it is, maybe 20 or 25% of those animals are fresh enough to do a real full, complete post-mortem exam down to the microscopic level and figure out why those animals died. And the real trend we've seen is a fairly high number of prime age breeding animals, particularly females, are dying much at a much higher rate than you would ever think would be possible for a population that is healthy. You'd really expect to see the high numbers of mortalities in the very young animals and the very old animals. So we're not seeing that sort of natural inverted bell curve in terms of death rate. We're seeing it show up where we're the animals that are the ones who should be producing pups and thriving in the best years of their lives are being challenged by disease and are dying at high rates.
Any speculation on what may be bringing about this unhealthy population?
Well, there are a number of things that we have determined do cause problems in sea otters. And it seems like what we're seeing mainly is that a lot of these things come from shore. So they're shore-based. They're basically human-caused things. So whether it's pollutants, agrochemicals, certain types of disease, chemical contaminants, pesticides. These are things that once they leach into the ocean, that's right where the otters live, right in the area closest to shore. So they probably get as much exposure as any animal out there. And since they live at the top of the food system there, they're going to get hit with those things, potentially harder than other species. So in fact, we're actually looking at sea otters as kind of an indicator species of both the health of the nearshore system as well as an indicator of maybe the impacts we're having on that system by the things we're doing on shore. Basically, those are the key things that we're looking at right now is how are some of these organisms, pathogens, contaminants, getting into the system? What is the vector for transmission? And also, there's still some questions about, why are sea otters seem particularly susceptible to some of these things? Are their immune systems suppressed? Are they, genetically, having had their population drop so low, genetically predisposed to certain diseases? And we're right in the midst of trying to address a lot of those key questions. We believe it's a very crucial time right now for the study of sea otters.
Well, certainly the effects of a runoff, particularly in your area there where there's so much agriculture and as well manufacturing and other things, that's a problem everywhere you go. But I often like to have people think about this. Sometimes they think, well, if the ocean is polluted, these animals are in there and it may affect them, but it really isn't just a matter of them floating around in some sort of polluted system where there may be chemicals that otherwise aren't healthy. But literally, this is like adding it to their drinking water because they're totally immersed in this world and environment, so it inundates their whole life at every level.
Exactly. I think they can't escape the little niche that they've carved out for themselves. They're very specialized in where they feed, and then they've grown into a role that is essential to that community. The kelp forests and the intertidal areas, sea otters are what's known as a keystone species, which means that when they're there, they have a profound effect on it. When they're removed from that system, they have a profound effect. And by and large, we believe that when they're removed from the system, it's a negative effect. The kelp forests, healthy kelp forests, are home to huge numbers of young animals that grow up, and many hundreds of species of animals reside in kelp forests. And if sea otters are removed from that system, other organisms, for instance, sea urchins and other animals, will come and actually prey on the kelp and really obliterate it. So we're concerned because the sea otters are so important within their system, and when their system gets fouled or polluted, some things may damage their physiology outright. For instance, particular contaminants, and other things are a bit more insidious, where types of organisms and disease get into their food system, and as they go around consuming these food items, the pathogens are basically concentrated, and they get sort of this blast of either contaminant or disease, and whether or not they can handle that is a tough question. If they're healthy, they might be able to withstand it, but if they are worn down a bit, sometimes these diseases just take hold and kill them outright.
What keeps them from expanding their range north and south?
They've done a fairly good job expanding their range. Back in the late 1980s, the thought was, well, let's move some animals to a new area and have them establish themselves so that if something catastrophic like an oil spill happened, it wouldn't just wipe out this fairly concentrated population. So some animals were moved to San Nicolas Island down in the Channel Islands in California, and that population never really took off. But there's still some animals there. They've seen, a fair amount of breeding over the years, but basically after nearly 20 years, the population is still, just a few dozen animals. So during that time, the sea otter continued to expand north and south. Initially, they moved north quite a ways, and more recently, they seem to be moving southward. So actually, their range now seems large enough where the everyone's sort of thinking, well, why don't the numbers grow more? They're spreading out, they're establishing new breeding territories. we would expect to see the numbers maybe increase rather than see them struggling trying to increase their numbers. In more recent years, we've seen that the northward growth has seemed to almost cease. Some speculation that the numbers of white sharks that seem to be in that area might be impeding their northward progress, but it's hard to say.
Well, that certainly would be a possibility, a nice luscious food source.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly right. Talk about some of their behaviors, because they're a very interesting animal, and this relationship between the otter and the sea kelp, as the otters go down, so to the sea kelp, but that's a unique relationship, but it relates directly to how they get along and what how they eat and live. So just give us some ideas of some of the aspects of the otter that makes them interesting and also important.
You know, I'm a little bit biased, but otters are really cool.
Well, I'm in perfect agreement with you there. I love otters. They're an interesting animal in the sense that they seem to pay attention. They like to play. They're very conscious. That's my interpretation.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think the you know the animal that we are looking at every day, you know, has amazing adaptations to try and survive in that little niche environment, and you know they've been doing it for you know maybe as long as a few million years, and their ability to manage their temperature in essentially water that's way too cold for them to survive. Certainly too cold for people for more than a short period of time. They've just developed many amazing physiological adaptations to deal with that. Their fur is the lushest of any animal that that lives on the planet. There are other adaptations to dive and to forage successfully in this habitat. They're extremely dexterous with these little short arms they have. And these little paws that don't look like they can grip or grab anything. There's these little flat, stubby paws, but they're extremely dexterous. They can manipulate and open just about any type of shellfish you put in front of them. And they're actually quite formidable. Most people think that they're these sort of cute, warm, fuzzy creatures that float out in the kelp, but they're you know they are related to badgers and weasels and minks and other sort of snarly creatures. So they are you know, when they open their mouth and are coming at you, they're something you don't want to tangle with.
They have attitude.
They definitely have attitude. Mm-hmm. And because most of the time to maintain their body temperature and get enough to eat, the time they need to socialize with other sea otters, they don't have a lot of time to, I don't know, be frivolous and mess with people very much. So on those few occasions where we do see people, approaching sea otters, it's a fairly risky business. They're just as inclined to you know maybe be aggressive as they are to flee.
Hmm.
But we've obviously have a lot of respect for them as a species, and certainly with individual otters, we do take animals in that show up sick or injured on the beach and try to restore them to health, and we also interact quite extensively with animals in the wild, capturing some of them for field research projects, trying to monitor, you know, how they're surviving and how long they survive, and so it's a, you know, quite a complex operation we have going on here.
They're actually a lot larger than some people may be familiar with compared to the freshwater otter.
Yep, quite a bit. The sea otters up in Alaska, some of those animals will get close to 100 pounds.
Wow, that's big.
Yeah. Male down here, you know, 65 pounds or so, and the females are about 45 to 50.
Mm. Now, you do a lot of field research, which we talked briefly about. That sounds kind of like fun, but tell me, what's a typical a field day for you like?
Well, when I can get out from behind the desk a little bit, you know, I join our colleagues and our in-house research staff. We work closely with the California Department of Fish and Game, closely with the U.S. Geological Survey sea otter team, and with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are a number of projects, mostly involve capturing sea otters and instrumenting them with radio transmitters, time depth recorders, other gear that allows us to monitor where they are, what they're doing, and really trying to understand how they're managing within their environment, what their both their diving physiology as well as their foraging behavior is, and the work that's happened over the last 4 or 5 years has tried to look at take kind of a holistic approach to things. It's looking at a lot of sea otters in different areas of the range extensively, and I'm talking about, you know, say following particular otters and finding them every day for a couple of years, and then capturing them later on and removing these timed depth recorders, and really trying to put together these fairly detailed profiles of how they've spent those years. And gradually this model emerges of how some of these animals are surviving, maybe what problems they run into, and we tie that in with the otters that die and the information we get from those animals. And again, we try and see what picture emerges from that, and by and large it fits in with what we're seeing with the dead otters, that that this population maybe is not as healthy as we'd like to see it, and we just haven't quite found that you know, that so-called smoking gun, that one big thing that might be at the root of all of it. So it's a complex issue. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of good cooperative work with all sorts of groups and agencies. And still, after all that, you know, we almost have more questions than answers at this point.
That's fascinating with the radio collar work. What can you tell us about their annual movements up and down the coast? Do they tend to stay in one place, or do they tend to, migrate, or maybe they do migrate? I don't know. But what are their habits that way?
It's a little bit sporadic. Some animals are very, very loyal to their sort of home range. Other animals will wander quite extensively. We had some project animals that were captured down in the San Simeon area. One day, one of those animals was located up past where we are here in Monterey, and so, you know, a few hundred miles. And later on in the year, he was back down south. So, you know, why would that animal make that sort of trip? Hard to say. We do see the male sea otters will tend to explore the shoulders of the range, so it seems like the males will tend to push the limits a bit and explore new territories. And over time, other animals will move in behind them, including females, and those areas eventually will be places where otters live all year round. So we've sort of seen that trend over time where, you know, males will push out a little bit. They may move in and out of that area over a number of years, and then finally they'll sort of establish themselves, and the females will come in, they'll produce some pups, and you know, new territory will become part of the range. But, you know, some otters just stay right where they are. Some otters have pups that stay in the same area, and it's hard to say which ones are inclined to move away from home and which ones tend to stay around.
Now, when I think of sea otters, I'm always thinking of them in the water. I really don't know if they spend time on terra firma.
They do, and more so than a lot of people think, and more so than even we thought even just a few years ago. We always were under the impression from the observations that have been done that otters up in Alaska, probably with the colder water temperatures, tended to haul out a bit more. But in California, the general sense was that most of these animals you know, eat, sleep, and breed in the water. They definitely have the vast majority of their pups are born when they're in the water. That's pretty much the impression I had up until fairly recently. You'd certainly see otters that aren't feeling well hauling out. You'd see some otters would haul out occasionally if they weren't feeling well. But more recently, as we've been doing more observations, we see these otters hauling out in fairly large numbers in very discrete areas, and that does seem to be related to their body condition, their health. So mainly in the winter months when, in the early parts of the year, when the kelp around here gets torn up a little bit with winter storms, and it's harder for them to go out and find a suitable place where they can relax without having to exert energy, we do see them haul out quite a lot. Particularly females with pups will come ashore in sort of the backside of rocks and other things where we don't usually see them very much, and spend a considerable amount of time there. And mostly what they're doing, we think, is just to stay warm, just trying to not burn so many calories.
So conceivably, these animals could spend their entire life in the water.
Yep. They're adapted for that, and if they stay in good condition, maintain their body weight, maintain their fur, they're well-suited to do that.
Now, at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, people are able to see sea otters there. Tell us about that.
Well, we have an exhibit here that's been around just about as long as the aquarium has. Yeah, we try to, you know, allow some nice growth in the tank, and we'll collect some algae and kelps periodically, and and put them in there and just kind of let the sea otters have at it. It's always been one of our most popular exhibits. People come from all over to this area to see sea otters at the aquarium, and it's also a good area to see them out in the wild. Often you can just walk right outside the aquarium's back door and see otters swimming by or out in the kelp or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because of the aquarium's position here in the Central Coast and many people associate us with sea otters and the Monterey area with sea otters, and I think that's why the aquarium's really decided to commit so much to help conserve sea otters. It's just kind of a natural thing.
Give people a visual on where the Monterey Bay Aquarium is as well.
Well, there's Monterey Bay, and basically Monterey is at the south part of this bay with Monterey at the bottom and Santa Cruz, California at the top, and a neat place called Moss Landing right about in the middle where this amazing submarine canyon just comes up very close to shore. The Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute has located itself there, and they've done all sorts of amazing things with undersea vehicles going down and exploring the deep canyon there. But our position is right at the end of what used to be the old canneries along Cannery Row, the old Hovedon Cannery. The aquarium building was conceived and designed and built to somewhat resemble the old cannery structures. And it's a beautiful building, beautiful on the inside, and it's a great place.
Now, if people want to find out more about your research, how can they do so?
There are a number of things they can do. First thing, they can go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium's website, which is www.montereybayaquarium.org. Go to the research and conservation section of our website, and there's information about sea otters and our program. I'd also recommend that they look other places on the web for some of these other groups, the U.S. Geological Survey, Western Ecological Research Service. They maintain all the information on how many sea otters there are and what parts of the coast they all live in and how many otters die every year and that sort of thing. That's an interesting thing if you're into the numbers. If you look for sea otters on the web, you're probably going to pull up something related to Monterey Bay Aquarium or one of our colleagues who's doing some pretty interesting work with sea otters.
Mm. Well, I certainly hope in the future here you'll be able to figure out what's causing the sea otter population to kind of slow down a little bit, because they're just a precious addition to our coastal zones. Andrew Johnson, manager of the Sea Otter Research Center at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, I want to thank you for adding your voice here to the Wildside News.
It was my pleasure.
It's a fascinating world, and there's a lot of wonderful people working every day to keep the living systems alive. And at the same time, the challenges of a globalizing world are adding strains that, quite frankly, many refuse to think strategically about. Sustainability, it is the new mantra of the environmental voice. We next head to San Francisco and learn about the Presidio School of Management that is the first of its kind to provide advanced degrees in sustaining our world. It's all ahead when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.